Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome back. This is episode 278 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. And if you have not read the title and you don't know who our guest is today, you are in for a treat. We have a Magic the Gathering Hall of Famer here with us today. But before we dive into this fantastic interview, I want to say thank you so much to you, the listeners, and especially to the patrons for keeping the show going, for supporting the show directly and keeping the lights on and things going. I really could not do the show without the support of the patrons, and I would not do the show if it wasn't for people listening. So thank you for tuning in and listening to the show and downloading it wherever it is that you find it. And it really means the world to me that someone else is on the other end listening to all these cool conversations that I get to have with these great Magic players. And also, I want to say thank you to Paragon City Games. They are a fantastic supporter of the show. Sometimes I have a company with whom our values align with so succinctly, and it's great that they happen to be local as well. I've been to their shop, absolutely love the atmosphere and all the events that they have going on over there. So if you're local to Utah, definitely check out Paragon City Games. If not, ParagonCityGames.com is where you can go to see what they are all about. So thank you to the patrons, and thank you to Paragon City Games. So I've been doing a lot of really cool interviews with some great Magic players, and if you are interested in asking questions to these guests that I have coming up, join the MTG Pro Tutor newsletter. It goes out every Thursday, and I'm going to start letting you know who I'm interviewing in the next week and giving you the opportunity to hit reply and ask a question, and then I can ask that to the guests that I have on the show. So, like I said, I've been doing several interviews, and I kind of do them in batches, so the next batch of interviews will be in a couple weeks from now. But join the newsletter, stay tuned, and when you see that a guest is coming up that you want to ask a question to, go ahead and hit reply and ask your question, and I will incorporate it into an upcoming interview. And the best way to join the newsletter is go to mtgprotutor.com, and there'll be either a splash page or right there on the homepage at the very top, there'll be an opportunity to put in your email address and join the newsletter that way. So I'm super pumped to share the interview that I had with our guest today with you. So without further ado, let's bring him in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I'm super excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest has an impressive 17 Grand Prix top eights and 11 Pro Tour top 16s, including 5 finishes in the top 8. Coming to us from Las Vegas, Nevada, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only Magic Hall of Fame Class of 2015 member, Eric Froelich. Eric, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share the audience tips and tricks to take the game to the next level?
Of course, always ready for that.
Excellent, sweet. Now, prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Eric, the best place to do that is on Twitter. He's very active there. You can find him at EFROPoker, and you just hit him up, say thanks for being on the show, ask one question, but that is the best place to interact with Eric. So, Eric, first and foremost, we love talking about the non-magic things, if any, about life. So, out there in Las Vegas, is magic all you do, or are you working doing anything else?
Definitely working on various projects. I mean, magic is... You know, it's been such a big part of my life for so long, but, you know, I've had a long poker career that I'm kind of shifting away from and, you know, kind of figuring out what the next chapter is going to be. You know, I live here in Las Vegas with my wife. We have a couple dogs. We're, you know, going to probably be starting a family pretty soon. So, kind of figuring out which path of the adult life to actually take.
Yeah, yeah. Figure with a name like EFRO Poker, that was, you know, I mean, part of your life and whatnot, but you're saying you're shifting away from that. And so it's always fun when you have those transitionary periods, got to figure out what you want to do when you grow up. So that's always fun to try out new things.
Yeah. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to find success in a lot of the things that I've done so far. So it's given me a fair amount of freedom to, you know, kind of explore, I guess.
Oh, that's great. That's really neat. So we love diving into the origin story of our guests, and we would love to hear, take us back in time and tell us a story of the first time you ever saw or played with Magic cards.
I can't remember where I first saw them, but it's pretty easy to figure out. It has to be somewhere around, you know, the schoolyard, just because it was 1994.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I kind of, from pretty close to the beginning, I mean, Legends was kind of coming off the shelves. The Dark was kind of fading away, and Revised was the big set at the time. And what ended up happening was in my fifth grade class, the entire class started playing Magic. It became like a big fad. All the boys, all the girls, everyone bought Magic cards. And so not necessarily everyone was playing Magic, but, you know, that's kind of the nice part about Magic. It can appeal to a wide audience. So people would collect the cards. They'd trade the cards. We actually had a pretty fantastic Virginia. And basically what happened was our classroom was set up as like a big economy. We had a political system. Mm. We had currency. We had jobs. We had, you know, all sorts of stuff that kind of mimics real life. And so it actually became something that people would buy and sell magic cards, and that was part of the economy, and everyone kind of played here and there. By the end of that year, once we got into 95, 96, I was kind of the last one standing. Everyone kind of shifted away. You know, it went from magic cards to pogs to, right. I don't even know what the next thing was, because I thought magic was interesting. So what ended up happening was I convinced my dad to drive me down to the local game store, and I was 10 years old. And we bought one of these revised starter kits, which is basically like two starter decks combined. And for people who haven't been playing for a long time, even starter decks are, you know, kind of a pretty old thing. But what used to happen was, you know, you could buy booster packs, same as now, 15 cards, although packs back then had a bunch of basic lands in them. So you get a random assortment, not just like one land in the back of the pack. So you might get like a land might be in your uncommon slot, and you can get a couple lands in your common slot, so you didn't really know what you were going to get. And then starter decks were kind of, you know, you'd get your three rares, you'd get your nine or maybe 10 uncommons, can't remember exactly, and you get a like 4 to 5 of each basic, and that would vary too, and then a bunch of commons. And so a starter kit would have two of those, so you'd get like 120 cards. You could more or less play with them right out of the box, although of course your deck would be terrible. But yeah, that's kind of where I started. And so me and my dad started playing, and my brother, who was 7 at the time, started playing. I tried to read the rule book. I didn't understand anything. So what ended up happening was my dad read the entire rule book, taught me and my brother the game because I couldn't understand it, and we went from there.
Love it. Wow, that's so cool. So what would you say was your first set? Would you consider it revised or the dark, or what do you say is your first set?
Yeah, revised.
Yeah. And so I got to ask, where did – you know, kind of your gaming bug or competitive bug come from? And so it sounds like it was kind of cultivated within the family. You got to play with your dad and your brother, and were you guys gamers growing up?
Not really. I mean, me and my brother played some amount of video games, but it wasn't that much. Didn't play that many board games. I mean, I kind of grew up with a lot of different video games, but I was never all that into it. Like if you describe even just like the average gamer, I'd be well below that. In terms of how much time I actually spent playing video games. Most of my video game playing was actually just sports video games. I grew up playing baseball, basketball, football. I wasn't the most athletic kid, but I was decent. And, you know, I ended up getting injured when I was, you know, kind of going into high school. So that kind of pushed me more into playing more competitive Magic because I couldn't really play sports anymore. Mm. And I still had that competitive urge. But to call myself a gamer, like obviously I am a gamer. Like I play Magic and poker and, right. and these type of games. But as far as like board games are concerned, I really don't play them. As far as video games are concerned, I can't remember the last year I played a video game. And before that, it was mostly just sports video games. So I wasn't really all that into the fantasy element, not really into role-playing games. So I think I'm really low on that gamer spectrum.
So what was it about Magic that got you hooked at a young age?
Strategy.
Yeah.
And competition.
Okay.
I like mental things. I like being able to wit. I don't think outsmart your opponents necessarily the right thing, but out-think. Being able to, yeah, it's very much a similar thing to what drew me into Magic and to poker is that, you know, there's hidden information, there's bluffing, there's trying to deduce what your opponent's most likely to have and to put yourself in a position where you're not going to necessarily make yourself 100% in any of the situations. There's always going to be variance. And of course, you're going to be wrong sometimes, but odds to increase your equity is always something that, you know, I kind of enjoyed. It's trying to kind of test myself and match myself up against my opponent, just like in a battle of the minds as opposed to a battle of strength.
So is it the player that knows more, prepares more, like, you know, so in poker, if you know the percentage of your, you know, your chances to win in a certain hand, and then Magic, there's obviously a lot of other things to go into, and if you've thought about those things ahead of time and you kind of come prepared with those things in mind, the person who has more of that is more favored, and is that the aspect that you like?
I mean, that's definitely a part of it. I like the fact that both of the games involve a lot of adjusting on the fly, because like if you were to shuffle a deck of poker cards and deal them out, you know, if you do that for the rest of your life, every second of every minute of every hour for the rest of your life, you're never going to have the same sequence of cards. Like no matter how many times you shuffle the deck, you're never going to have them come out in the same order. And it's obviously the same thing with a Magic deck. So, you know, the games have that wide amount of variety where yes, if you prepare in advance and have a solid foundation and game plan, you're going to put yourself ahead. But being able to adjust and think on the fly is such a critical part of both games, because you're not going to see the exact same situations come up very often. You'll see similar situations where you can draw on your past experience, which is important. But being able to adjust, especially because Magic, even if you draw the same set of cards in your hand, your opponent might draw a completely different set of cards. They might play a completely different deck. And so being able to figure out, how I'm going to adjust to that, how I'm going to adjust to their next draw step, because the board changes every turn. The same thing in poker, the board changes with every turn of the card. So figuring out what's going on and how to maximize your win percentage, because, that's basically all you can do. You try to maximize your win percentage, and that doesn't even mean you're going to win. Like, trying to turn your 10% equity into 12% equity is a lot. That really adds up over, I said I've been playing Magic for 24 years now. Like, think about how many times those 2% come up over a 20-year span. It's a ton. And so every time you're able to increase your win percentage by even just 1%, you're adding a lot more game wins over the course of your career, and that really matters.
Yeah. So in your time playing Magic, what has been your favorite set?
I think it's probably Invasion. Like, that was kind of the set where, I was kind of playing my first Pro Tours. I think it was just a really well-designed set. Like, I like the fact that you can certainly go five colors. There are cards like Harrow and Career on Elf and Fertile Ground that all kind of fix your mana. And then none of the cards were really super overpowered. The games would definitely draw out. You could get mana screwed, and it wouldn't mean you just lose. Like, a lot of Magic nowadays, a lot of the reason I'm not as into Magic in some ways, or kind of pushed back from Magic a little bit, is that the way it's designed right now, it's definitely pushing in that direction of, if you miss a land drop, you're just going to lose a massive percentage of the time. And there's not a lot of room to recovery, a lot of room to, get to make decisions to try that are actually going to be impactful, I guess. Like, you can make decisions that will make your win percentage slightly higher. But again, if you're talking about going from 3% to 3.5%, that's relevant, but it not necessarily feel good. Whereas back in the day, those sets, you're playing some of the best cards in the set are, Repulse was basically, Crashing Tide, where you didn't need a Merfolk, where, that's still a good card, but, that was like a really incredible card back then. And Cavu Climber, a recent reprint in Masters, like 5-mana 3/3 draw card. Like, these are first pickable cards in that set. And, that's just kind of, those cards lead to more games being played. Like, you're spending 3 and 5 mana to, bounce a creature or play a 3/3, and you get to draw a card each time that, allows you to dig deeper into your deck to find, your more relevant spells. So a lot of cool things going on there, and definitely a set that I really enjoyed playing with.
Cool. Along the same lines, what's one of, because there's thousands, one of your favorite cards?
Shivan Dragon.
All right. So I know that is, but for those of us who don't know, what is it? What does it do? And why do you like that one so quickly?
So it's red, 4, 6 total mana for a 5/5 flyer. And, it had the original fire breathing mechanic of you pay a red, give it +1/+0. And it was just kind of the coolest card. Like, I think that Shivan Dragon is probably responsible for, I don't want to estimate the number, but a huge number of players continuing to play Magic and money being brought into Wizard of the Coast, because that, having that iconic dragon when you're, kind of younger, and you get to see that, and you get to, it was just so cool, I guess. And so that artwork, especially, like, the reprinted Shivan Dragons with the new art, it's still cool looking, but I'm not really a fan of it. It's that original iconic
Melissa Benson one with the claws kind of down towards the picture, and I can see it in my mind. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, that just was like, stood out to me so much as a kid. There are definitely times in my life in the past few years where I've been like, I'm going to try to collect every Alpha Shivan Dragon there is in the world. And then, it just turns out that card just keeps going up and up. So it's not really realistic. I mean, a lot of them out there, pushing $1,000. So, okay, that's not going to happen, but, it's still pretty cool. And I got a few of them at least.
And you know what? Like, I mean, even as you said, so first of all, and you put to the history right here. You're the first one to say Shivan Dragon as your favorite card. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, when you said that, so I came in. So Tempest was the first stuff that I really remember. I remember playing Stronghold and all that cool Weatherlight stuff. But I still remember, like, as soon as you said Shivan Dragon, I think of the Melissa Benson one and how iconic that card is and whatnot. And so, yeah, when you say that, it probably was responsible for many people staying hooked and just catching, you know, players right in the fantasy. I totally agree. I can definitely see it, how that would be. Such a classic
the iconic
card.
Art and the iconic frames and all the old cards. Like, I really get a lot of nostalgia towards that. I started collecting, you know, after I've, you know, had some success in my life and been able to afford a few more things. Like, I've been building a complete set of Beta and Arabian Nights and Antiquities just to, you know, kind of have that nostalgia feel. Yeah. And also, like, I just like to look at it. Like, as far as art is concerned, just going through the binder and the pages of these old cards, and it's just kind of fantastic for me. So, my favorite cards kind of all go back to artwork related things and things from my childhood. Like, you know, other cards on that list would be cards again from Alpha, you know, Birds of Paradise, Counterspell. And it's not necessarily from playing the cards, although I still enjoy playing those two cards today. I haven't had very much experience in my life playing Shiv and Dragon. It's never really been that incredible, except when I was a kid and playing, you know, more casual. You know, it was never really a tournament playable card, but it still just stands out as such an important piece.
Yeah. So sticking with, you know, the game for so long and playing in many arenas and all through just many different archetypes and everything, it takes a lot of dedication. So diving into that a little bit, first of all, what does that word even mean to you? What is dedication?
Well, I mean, I don't know how much dedication I've ever had as opposed to just, it's just doing the thing you enjoy. Like, Magic for me, I've taken steps back from Magic. I've taken long breaks from Magic. I mean, when I went to college, I still played out a few Pro Tours in my first year of college, but my results were basically no day twos. And, you know, I was on the Master Series back then, which was kind of a different version of Platinum, where they would invite the top 32 players. It would be a single elimination tournament, and you'd get thousands of dollars per win effectively. And so I'd had a great season the season before, so I was kind of on this Master Series, but it was my first year of college. I was kind of transitioning away from Magic, and I couldn't really afford to not show up, since last place got $2,000 and there was, you know, a Pro Tour attached to it too. But, you know, I wasn't really putting my all into it and wasn't taking it very seriously. And I ended up taking kind of a step back from Magic for many years. I, you know, moved various places in the world. I focused on poker for a long time. You know, from that 2002, I had a really good season on the Pro Tour. 2003 is the one I'm kind of describing, where I took a step back. I played a couple Pro Tours here and there over the next few years, but not really. And then didn't play at all again until 2010, when I got, you know, a special invite from poker to come back to Magic. So, I don't know how much it for me at least revolves around dedication. I don't feel necessarily all that dedicated, except to try to maximize my own enjoyment. And so, when a lot of the American players that I was good, you know, it was kind of everyone, the professional scene in that 2002 to 2004 area, all the Americans kind of drifted away to poker. It was, you know, Bob Maher, Neil Reeves, Brian Kibler, John Finkel, myself, Ben Stark, like all of these players who kind of put up a lot of great results in that 2002, 2003 were kind of shifting away in 2004, 2005 to the point that, you know, they weren't really there anymore. And that was when, you know, Luis Scott Vargas and Paul Cheon kind of burst on the scene, but, you know, none of us had ever heard of those guys when they started crushing nationals, and there were no other names that we even recognized that were kind of doing well in the American scene for that while. You know, Kai crushed for, of course, a long time, and the Japanese players rose to prominence and really put up some fantastic results. You know, Kenji and Oiso and some fantastic players did really well, but the American scene just kind of dried up quite a bit for some time. And so, you know, I was just kind of following my heart and following what I was enjoying at the time. And it wasn't a dedication to anything other than, you know, maximize my own enjoyment.
You know, so dedication is, you know, being wholly devoted to something. And in this case, I like that peek into, you know, your life and being dedicated to, like you said, enjoying, you know, your experience, whether that happened to be in Magic or elsewhere and whatnot. So that's pretty neat. You mentioned college a couple of times. What did you study?
I went to University of Virginia and studied psychology for a couple of years and did not finish. So not the role model for finishing college, unfortunately. Like, what ended up happening for completely non-Magic related things was, you know, I took a couple of years, and then my mom ended up getting diagnosed with brain tumors, and I started playing more poker. I qualified for the World Series of Poker, took some time off to be with my mom, who ended up having successful surgery. She's still well and alive today. And I ended up qualifying for you know, the World Series of Poker main event, I won a package online like 2 days after I turned 21 and went out to Vegas, ended up winning a World Series of Poker bracelet and kind of couldn't really make sense of it to go back to college when I had so many opportunities. Yeah. Poker was so big at the time.
Yeah.
You know, the boon had just happened. I ended up getting an offer from, you know, one of the biggest poker sites to kind of represent them. And so, I mean, while I never really loved poker, there are of course aspects I really liked, but, you know, it was kind of felt more like a job as opposed to Magic, felt more like fun for, you know, somewhat similar games.
Right.
I mean, the opportunities poker provided were kind of too great to pass up for myself and my family. So, that was kind of the direction I went in.
Wow. That's what a story, man. Obviously being able to sum that up in a few minutes is totally different than, you know, living through it. And I'm glad that everything ended up okay with your mom and that you end up doing so well at poker. And you're right. Sometimes those, you know, crossroads in life again, you're like, doesn't really make sense to go back when I'm doing so well doing this other thing. So that's great. When you started getting competitive with Magic, either, you know, the very first time or one of the times you came back, whatever, what what was an early challenge that you faced that you eventually overcame?
Well, when I first started playing more seriously, I guess to start even before I started playing, I guess competitively, like on the larger scale, I used to play kind of in the local store in Northern Virginia. And I won a lot, like a lot. Like FNM hadn't existed yet, but, you know, they'd have weekly, you know, type two tournaments, which was standard at the time. And I believe that I won like 36 of them in a row kind of thing.
Wow.
And I was not shy about it or let's just say I was incredibly cocky. I was a child. I was very, you know, confident and cocky and everyone knew it. And I wouldn't want to be around that version of myself. Like it was not good. And so that was definitely a large issue just on, you know, you're 14-year-old kid and acting like you're better than people. That's a big issue no matter how old you are, but it's even more ridiculous when you talk about you're at a store full of adults and, you know, just not treating people with enough respect. And so that was a big personal issue of mine. And then when I started transitioning to play more professional Magic, I really wasn't into Constructed anymore. I really just tried to qualify for the limited Pro Tours I would play because they weren't mixed Pro Tours back then. It was Constructed and then limited, and then it kind of went back and forth. And so I would play just, you know, the sealed deck limited PTQs. I won a pretty good percentage of them. I would go play the limited Pro Tour and then not play the Constructed Pro Tour type thing. So figuring out that balance of, hey, if I'm actually going to do this thing, I'm going to have to play Constructed as well, because I played a handful of limited Pro Tours before I even considered playing Constructed one. I ended up losing a win in at Pro Tour LA in like 2001, I think. Maybe it was 2002, to Camille Cornelison, who ended up making it in the Hall of Fame. And then, you know, that kind of put me on the Pro Tour a little bit more. Hmm. We ended up playing together in the Team Pro Tour that followed with Kyle Rose. Again, lost a win in for top four there and finished seventh. And yeah, then it kind of launched me into having kind of a great season there. But, you know, figuring out how to, you know, act like a mature person was definitely challenge number one. And then to try to embrace Constructed and kind of go from there.
So what opened your eyes, I guess, to how you were and how you were affecting other people? And then what did you do to kind of, and obviously it's, part of it's a time thing, maturing comes with age and stuff like that. But was there anything else that you can point out that you did or that helped you kind of move beyond being how you were at, you know, cocky at 14?
I mean, I think it just kind of has to do more with growing up. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, now I'm fairly old. I'm in my 30s. But growing up, I was always the young one. Like, everyone around me, all the people I played with, you know, that list of people I gave you earlier on of, you know, the guys I hung out with, the Americans, like, they were all older than me. And so hanging out with people who were older than you and kind of mimicking their actions and realizing, you know, how you're supposed to be. And again, just growing up, natural growing pains and figuring out that, hey, people don't want to be around this. I don't want to be around this. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to change. And so it's, you know, we're talking 20 years ago. I don't remember an exact specific incident, right. But, you know, it, definitely struggling with, you know, who I am on the inside, not being able to handle losses particularly well. All sorts of different issues are still things that have plagued me up until the past few years. And so just having great influences in my life and having, you know, surrounding yourself with good people who, you know, will support you even when you mess up and kind of show you the right way is always important.
And you mentioned kind of getting into constructive, for example. So what can you share to people who, you know, they might have a format that they're, that they like, whether it's limited or constructed or whatever, but they want to, or they want to kind of spread their wings and try other formats. What advice can you give them as they're, you know, trying to embrace a new format?
I mean, just do what you enjoy is kind of the bottom line. I mean, right now Magic is so widely available and so popular, and you know, this wasn't really a thing back when I'm talking, you know, like in the time that I'm referring to, 20 years ago, like Magic Online didn't exist. There weren't kind of these ways to dip your toes in to try new things, to, you know, I think there's a lot of different resources you can use to rent decks and be able to, mm-hmm. you know, borrow from friends to get in cheaply to just try new things, which, you know, didn't exist. Like if you wanted to play a new deck, you had to find the cards, which wasn't always easy. You had to find a place where they're actually going to have a tournament, which wasn't always easy. So it's very much a different world. And the really nice thing about Magic today is that how many resources there are. I mean, there are no podcasts, there are no websites with strategy articles that you could get for free from the best players in the world. Like, this didn't exist. If you broke the format, if you had this great standard deck, you know, it could be weeks and months before anyone even knew about it, just because that's how information traveled. Like, it wasn't the day of the internet. And so it was just a very different world. And right now, formats get broken very quickly. People find the optimal versions of decks between Magic Online and, you know, just all the information out there, which is just totally a different game in so many ways because of that. But now if you want to try things, you can see, hey, what does Owen Turtenwald, what does Jerry Thompson, what does Reed Duke, what does, you know, all of these people, how do they build this deck? How do they approach, you know, these matches? You can watch their videos of them playing the decks. It's like, this is crazy. I mean, compared to how it was 20 years ago, where it's just like, all right, let's try a new thing. See what happens. Go to the local store. We have once a week to try to play.
Yeah. Oh, man. So from the beginning all the way up until, you know, now, including, you know, your induction into the Hall of Fame, you know, you've, you know, had an awesome journey full of ups and downs. And before we get into the peaks and valleys, one of the things I want to touch on is, in addition to, you know, good finishes, part of the Hall of Fame criteria is, I don't know if it's written down anywhere, but kind of being a community member that people can look up to. And that, I feel, involves a lot of sportsmanship. And so I wanted to ask, what does sportsmanship mean to you, and how have you, yeah, any examples you've seen of that, either from yourself or from others in your Magic journey?
I think that sportsmanship is probably the thing that, you know, what I touched on earlier, that I've definitely struggled the most with, just from, you know, my own inner demons and personality of, you know, just feeling, I guess, I hate to say it because it feels bad to say, but, you know, somewhat a sense of entitlement, which I think is a bad thing to feel. And so trying to overcome that is something that, you know, I spend a lot of time with. And, you know, it used to be really hard on me, I think, especially, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, when I'm trying to kind of build up this Hall of Fame career and put up these results. And let's say I put in the time and I have a great deck and I played really well. And, you know, you just kind of get manuscript or something crazy happens and you lose. And, you know, it's for a lot. Like, when you're talking about playing on the pro tours and you play these high stakes matches, you don't get very many of, like, with how much variance there is in Magic, mm-hmm. to even get in the position where you're going to play one of those matches. It doesn't come around all the time, just because there'll be plenty of times where, you know, just stuff happens well before you get to that point of playing the high stakes match. So once you get there, to have something, you know, quote unquote terrible or really unfortunate or just something that really stings happen, it hurts. And, you know, this is something I talked about a couple times before in other places, but, you know, I ended up posting, I think this was 4 or 5 years ago, actually maybe even more, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, even on Facebook, just asking people how they deal with tilt. Like, this was in the middle of a pro tour. I'd just taken another hard loss. And I'm like, how do you guys deal with this? And it was Patrick Sullivan, who of course is known for doing commentary on SCG. Who responded, he's like, listen, whenever, you know, you take one of these tough losses, if you put it out there, let's say you put on social media about how lucky your opponent got, or that, you know, you got mana screwed, and, you know, you really are just kind of taking away from what they accomplished, and they're a real person on the other side. Like, that win might mean a lot to them, that they might have felt like, you know, they did something really fantastic, and, you know, this is very valuable to them, and this is a part of their journey. And to try to take anything away from potentially what that meant to them, that's a big cost. And it's not something I'd ever thought about before, that, hey, just because, you know, this loss felt, you know, a little bit unjust to you, doesn't mean that you kind of have that right to take anything away from anyone else who is on the other side of the table. And so, you know, try to think about it from both sides of the spectrum, and realizing that, you know, we're all people here. Mm-hmm. Like, this is part of the game. This is what you signed up for. And yeah, it hurts, and everyone feels bad about things sometimes, but how you handle it afterwards is definitely an important part. So, you know, I always tell my opponent, you know, good game, shake their hands, and they beat me. Like, good luck on the top eight or day two or whatever it is when, you know, they knock me out, and, you know, it's on to the next one. Like, that's just kind of what you signed up for. And, you know, you want them to have a great time too.
Yeah, that's so true. So, in this journey, what would you say has been your worst Magic moment, and what did you learn from that experience?
What's my worst Magic moment?
Yeah, no worry. We'll flip side and get to the ups, but we'd love to learn from.
I don't even know what direction to kind of take that in.
It could be a near miss. It could be just an experience or interaction, or just and something that pops up.
I don't really have a lot of bad net. Like, here's the thing. Like, I both do and have a ton of bad moments like that, and I also kind of have none, just because they all kind of blend together. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a whole bunch of top 16s. I have a whole bunch of, you know, just missing various things that really mattered, whether it's the world championships or, you know, something else. Where the thing is, like, you can go back to all different points. I mean, yeah. The one that stands out the most, we were playing Cobblade in Pro Tour Paris, that, you know, Channel Fireball just kind of completely broke the format there. We were all kind of at the top of the standings, and so we played against each other a whole bunch of times, and, you know, kind of knocked a bunch of people out, but we ended up having two in the top eight. Ben Stark won it, and four more in the top 16. So, kind of an incredible run. I ended up finishing ninth in that tournament, but I was kind of the one doing the best for a while with two rounds to go. I had two win and ends, and I was playing against Vincent Lemoine, who, you know, just played in the Magic Online Championships this past couple weeks, earlier this month, I guess it was. I'm not sure exactly what the weekend was, but, you know, for anyone who watched that. So, you know, a great player, I believe from Belgium, and we're in game three, and I effectively have the game locked up, except a couple turns earlier I'd cast Divine Offering, which was in our sideboard. It was the first time in the entire tournament I cast it. I'd never cast the card before in my life, even though it is a card originally from Legends, and had been around for, you know, decades. I had never actually cast the card before. Didn't know exactly what it did. Ends up, it destroys an artifact and you gain life equal to its converted mana cost. I cast it on an enchantment. And so, you know, people were watching. Mm-hmm. You know, he allowed it to resolve. I gained the life. You know, there's a big crowd, of course, watching, and the judge is like, well, you can't do that. Okay, so we had to back it up. Mm-hmm. I never adjusted my life total. Oh. And so I ended up playing the rest of this game with my life total being wrong. And this was before they had changed that rule of you need to, you know, that's not something that you're allowed to have wrong. And so I ended up making a play several turns later in a game that I could have effectively had 100% locked up if I had the right life total written down. I could have ended up casting what it was Oust on my own creature to gain a few extra life. But as it was, there was nothing that could kill me because of the life total I had on the pad. And he ended up casting the burn spell. And I'm like, okay, I go to two. It's like, no, you're dead. I'm like, okay, I have the wrong life total. And so it ended up costing me that match. And of course, I ended up losing the next one as well and not making top eight. So that one definitely stung. It was tough, you know, going out to Paris, jet lagged, exhausted by the end of, you know, day two of this tournament. I've been doing so well, and just, you know, mental misstep. Like, that's what it was. And just had the wrong life total, didn't fix it. Could have won, could have locked up that top eight. Of course, our deck was, you know, the most broken deck anyone's ever played in a Pro Tour, I think. And so it would have definitely given myself a chance to win the PT, which would have been cool, but, you know, didn't work out. But, you know, I've five top eights, and I've only gotten out of the first round once. And there, I lost in the top four. Hmm. My loss in the top four was to Tom Martell, and in game five when he had mulligan to five, and I had a pretty decent draw. So there are definitely things I probably could have done to win that game. So I mean, there's so many different things. Like when you've been playing 20 something years, and you have those five top eights and six top 16s, and however many near misses in GPs, and how many GP finals I've lost a bunch of those. Like all of them sting in a way, but at the same time, I don't think about them. Like I'm thrilled with my Magic career. If I never win another match, I'll feel like I had an incredible career. And I feel like that was the case years ago even. So, it's kind of all gravy at this point. I don't take Magic particularly serious right now. I mean, that could certainly change going forward, but right now it's just something I kind of enjoy and playing, at a professional level, but definitely in a more casual way where winning and losing is just not of that much importance to me. I'm not chasing platinum or world championships or anything this year. I'm really just not going all out, I guess. And so, would it have been great to have won, a few more critical matches and, had seven top eights or eight top eights or, won the Pro Tour? Yeah, that would all be great, but that's not what happened. So not a big deal.
Casually competitive or casually professional, I guess. And first of all, I want to commend you on your referencing of a mental misstep, which you can pay life to Cass in a story involving miscalculated life totals. That was very classy. Well done. Well done. I caught that.
And what are you
gonna do? So on the flip side are our highs. What has been your proudest Magic moment?
Making to the Hall of Fame.
What does that mean for you?
It kind of just means everything when you're talking about like the game itself. Like there's kind of nothing else. It's you're basically being celebrated for everything you've done. And so, it's kind of the culmination. It's, you performed, in tournaments and you contributed in articles and podcasts and various other things. And, all of these contributions and your own accomplishments have earned you the highest honor you can get in the game. And what could possibly mean more than that? And so, obviously all the steps along the way to have gotten there, all mean a lot, but this is kind of just that crown jewel, I guess.
Awesome. So as you have played Magic all over the world against thousands of people and just all the games you played, what would you say is the biggest mistake that you have seen players make?
That players can like consistently make?
Yeah, that you've noticed that players struggle with this or something that we can draw on and talk about and learn from.
I don't think that figuring out one mistake is really a possible thing, but I mean, there's definitely a lot that I feel like I've tried to touch on a little bit throughout the podcast. Maximizing your win percentage, and I feel like a lot of people when they get to that point where that win percentage becomes low, once you get significantly below 50%, people tend to stop caring as much. Once you're like 22% to win, let's say, just throw a number out there. If you can increase that to 25%, that's a huge difference. I mean, you're talking about effectively 10% more likely than you should have been to win. And so that those really add up over time. And I feel like people don't do enough to maximize. It goes the same the other way. I mean, turning your 97%er into a 99%er, sure, you win that game still 97 times out of 100. You're not going to notice that your mistakes are costing you all that often because, we're talking about small percentages. But again, over time, these things add up. And so they all kind of tie in together. It goes back to results-oriented thinking, people going like, well, I could have done this, but it didn't matter because, I wouldn't have gotten there anyway. It's just like, no, you need to start making those correct plays because some of the time you would have gotten there and that time that, you added the 2% would really pay off. And of course, when you're talking 2%, 50 times, 50 to 1, you're just, it's not going to matter, but the one time it could mean a lot. It could be the difference between, qualifying for the Pro Tour or not qualifying for the Pro Tour. And you really want to maximize those things. And so not giving up when you're way far behind and not, kind of phoning it in a little bit when you're incredibly far ahead. These things of making sure that you hold on to those last couple percentage points or that you gain those last couple percentage points where you can, they matter a lot. Like if you're going to play a lot of Magic over the years, you're going to see that those numbers, that's just a huge difference.
So how do you maximize your chances to win in game? What does that actually look like?
It mostly comes down to not losing focus. Like a lot of these things, when you're really far behind or really far ahead, you're just not really thinking about, like when you're really far behind, you're not always thinking about what's the best way I can win this game. When you're really far ahead, you're not always thinking about, okay, how can I actually lose this game and how do I prevent that? It just goes into a lot of autopilot. And we all play on autopilot all the time when you play a lot. It's just hard not to. You know, it's Magic tournaments are grueling. If you're going to play 15 rounds of something where you know your brain has to be on the whole time, and you have to keep analyzing every card you draw, every card they draw, and everything they play, you know, it just adds up over time until you really do have to play an autopilot from here to here and there. But people just go kind of too autopilot, I guess, in games that aren't extremely close. So, and actually, people vary dramatically in what type of person they are. There's definitely a school of people who kind of give up quite a bit when they're incredibly far behind, whereas there are other people who that's when they really focus. And those same type of people you'll often see when they're incredibly far ahead start to play looser, while the ones who, you know, who I said are kind of phoning it in when they're really far behind, when they're really far ahead, they might really focus a lot more and you know, kind of guarantee that win. Yeah. That's definitely something I've seen a lot over the years of people who kind of fall on one end of those spectrums of where their focus really matters in the blowout games. But, you know, all games count, and that's kind of the thing. I mean, it doesn't really matter what round it is. It doesn't really matter what your record is. You know, you still have a chance to do something if you're in the tournament, and so you really want to maximize that.
Excellent. So, like you said, just staying focused and actively thinking, you know, how can I lose this game, you know, if you're ahead? And then if you're behind, like, what do I need to do? Like, how can I win this game? And really kind of just running through and thinking about, you know, how to get another draw or what you can do to just eke out, you know, a few more turns to try and draw your outs. And is doing those things that, you know, that keep you in it, that give you that chance to actually draw what you need and get out of it.
Right. Look at like an Owen Turtenwald or a Reed Duke, and you do not see them concede games. Like, even, I mean, if you play against Reed Duke, he's tapped out with no cards in hand at 3 life. You show him Lightning Bolt, he'll tell you to tap your mana. Like, that's how Reed Duke plays Magic. And so, and telling you to tap the mana is a little bit on the extreme side. I don't think there's any real need for that. I like when people just show me the card, like, okay, we can go on to the next game. But, you know, the fact that they don't concede, the fact that, you know, you... It always puts your opponent like in the back of their mind when you're not conceding in a game where it looks like it's over. It's like, well, do they have something here? Like, should I not attack with everything? Like, they definitely have won tons of games over the years where, you know, their opponent's not going to go out for the all-out attack because, hey, there's this sequence of cards or there's this settle the wreckage that, sure, there's basically no chance they could ever have it based on how the game played out. But, you know, now I'm just going to try to play around it because they're not conceding. They haven't changed their expression. I'm just going to kind of change the way I play. And sometimes it lets them back into games. Like, you know, you only have to win one out of every 100 or so games before, you know, that's a big difference. Like, becoming a person who wins 66% of your games to 65% of your games, you know, that is going to add up a lot over the course of playing hundreds of tournaments, which these guys do. So these things matter.
That's cool. So what is an aspect of Magic that you have been able to apply to other areas of your life?
I mean, Magic and poker have kind of gone hand in hand. Like, the crazy thing, like, my first World Series of Poker final table, I'm 21. I've never even played live poker. Like, at the beginning of this tournament, the first time I got dealt cards, I'm like, wait, how am I supposed to hold these? Like, I've never even dealt with playing poker in a live setting before. That's how young and new to the game I was. And yet, we got to the final table. First place in this tournament is hundreds of thousands of dollars. There's ESPN cameras everywhere. They're interviewing me. And it really didn't faze me at all. And 100% of the reason for that is because when you take a bunch of 18-year-old kids, put them on the big stage with all the lights and cameras rolling and have them play for tens of thousands of dollars in Magic, it prepares you for these real-life situations. And so when it came to just like stress and, you know, just all of these different issues that you could have playing for high stakes in other areas or the various things involving that, Magic really helped set me up. And of course, just generally figuring out lines of play, figuring out how to read people, like all of this stuff really mattered for poker. Outside of like actual game related things, I mean, the things that Magic has brought me and taught me the most is just all have to do with people. I mean, all of my closest friends are people I've met through Magic. My, you know, wife now is someone I met through Magic. Like, everything in my life was kind of brought about by Magic, because so many, like, the people who play Magic are definitely a special group, and there's so many like-minded people that you don't seem to find in very many other walks of life and anything else I've done, and that includes poker. Like, the people in Magic are worlds better than the people I found in poker. I mean, there's plenty of great people in poker, and right, there's of course a lot of people who are in both, but right, by and large, that the Magic community has so many fantastic people who really are just kind of these caring individuals who approach life and games and all sorts of things in a very similar way. So it's kind of just a great resource.
That's awesome. Yeah. The people, I love how you bring that up, because that's one of my favorite parts, you know, the community, the people, you know, being able to meet and interact with, you know, people like you and the other guests and the listeners and the players that I play against. That I love that. I love how it's an opportunity to get out and meet people. When I go to a new city, for example, you know, and I moved around quite a bit when I was in the Navy. And when we would go to a new city, I could go to my LGS and boom, like almost, you know, within a couple of weeks, I, you know, have friends that I was able to just kind of go and make through being able to play Magic. And so the people, I think, is one of the big things for me as well. So it's neat that you touched on that. So that's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get to go play the local tournaments all that often, although even like this last weekend, I went up to Friday Night Magic and it's all people I've never met before. And they're all just having a good time and enthusiastic and want to talk about Magic cards and future decks and what sets are coming out. And just like having these things where you kind of just relate to people, on the local level is great, but it goes so much beyond that. I mean, the number of friends I've made from Europe and Japan and Australia, and just like, where would you ever find this?
Yeah.
Like, the fact that I can communicate and play and have effectively conversations with, you know, Yuya and Shoto don't even speak the same language as me. It's like, it's pretty crazy.
That's cool. So when you go locally, do people recognize you? Do they know who you are?
It depends. I mean, there's definitely a handful of people who are very big into that stuff and follow the pro scene and think that kind of stuff is really cool. But I think that most of the time I play in a local event, I mean, I play a lot of the pre-releases, people don't follow the professional scene. Like, they don't really know the pro tour exists. They don't really care. They don't know who necessarily the players are. And so there's a huge percentage of people who, you know, care a lot. And, you know, I write a daily column, you know, you can see me kind of everywhere. On a lot of different Magic sites, if that's something you're interested in, but a lot of people just aren't. Like, they play the game because they enjoy the game, and trying to figure out the optimal way to build their Jun deck or how to sideboard in the blue black versus Hazoret matchup is just not that important to them. They're just going to hang out and play the game that they love, and I think that's pretty awesome that there's such a wide variety.
That's pretty fun. So real quick, earlier you mentioned during the Pro Tour Paris story, traveling and jet lag and whatnot. As far as traveling goes, I mean, how you dealt with that? So, you know, traveling and being jet lagged for tournaments, how long does it take you to get un-jet lagged when you, just kind of general travel stuff, like what's kind of been some of your travel log highlights?
I hate traveling.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. Like, it's something that I kind of got forced to do. I wish that when I was younger, when I could handle traveling a little bit better, that I spent more time, I guess, in some of the places I've been, because I've been all over the world many times. I mean, I don't even know how many dozens of times I've been to Europe. I guess I haven't been to Japan all that often. I haven't really been anywhere else in Asia, but I mean, it's still been 6 or 7 times, since I just haven't really done all that much in a lot of places, because growing up I didn't care as much. Now I'd probably spend a little bit more time there, but you know, there's just so many things always going on at home, and such a desire to be with my family and in my own house, that traveling's really hard. I'm a big guy, traveling's uncomfortable, I don't sleep very well. Like, sleeping in my own bed I'm decent at, but on the road it's especially hard. So I'm one of the people who really dislikes traveling, and it's a huge part of why I just don't really take things as seriously. I mean, A of all, I can't be at that, you know, fully competent, I guess, level when I have to travel far to play in a tournament. It's just very hard to be adjusted and rested and then be able to focus for long enough. Like, I definitely struggled quite a bit at the end of tournaments a lot of different times. And so it's tough. I've gotten to the point in my life where I really don't look forward to it. And every time I go to the airport, my wife asks me, "Oh, are you excited? You know, going to Japan or going to, you know, Spain. It's like, no,
nope.
I really, I'm not excited. It'll be cool once I'm there. Right. I'll enjoy it a little bit when I'm not tired, but the travel to get there, it kills me. And, I don't know. There's also a pretty big, delta, I guess, between the beds in my house and in a lot of American and North American establishments, as opposed to if you go to Japan or to Spain, it's not really always feasible to find a nice, big, comfortable bed, especially for under like $1,000 a night. So that's definitely something that has hurt me quite a bit over the years. But
so yeah,
I mean,
knowing
the thing
that
I like the most though is the food. Like, going to Japan, like if I could just teleport, I'd be in Japan all the time.
Got it.
I think being there is amazing. The culture is amazing. The food is beyond my favorite. Like, I absolutely love Japanese food. And so there's so many great things, but man, traveling is tough.
So knowing that, what have you done to be able to kind of, you know, still be able to play, you know, at these big level, at these big tournaments or focus that you can share with maybe other people who are in similar situations where they travel to play is not their favorite thing. How can they stay, you know, locked on and focused even if traveling is not their thing? What have you done?
I'm not the best to answer this one because I guess my answer is mostly just suck it up. But just got to deal with it. I mean, I count down the days of when I get to go home a lot of times, especially recently now that I'm getting older. But there's not really all that much you can do. I mean, there are various things that people suggest you can try to fight jet lag. And jet lag isn't even that bad for me. It has more to do with just, you know, the beds in general. I don't even try super hard to fight it. Like, I'll land in Europe and it'll be, you know, effectively like 4 a.m. my time, but it's the middle of the afternoon there. And so I'll just go to sleep, but I'll just set an alarm. You know, I'll sleep for a couple hours. And then when I'm tired at night, I'll try to go to sleep for as long as I can and try not to worry about it too much. Now, if you have to fly in for an event and, you know, you're getting there the day before it starts, well, yeah, you're screwed. Like, there's nothing you can realistically do. But, you know, if you're able to get there a couple of days early,
okay,
there's a good chance you're still going to be kind of tired, but I mean, that's kind of just all I do. I don't have any kind of magic solution. I mean, obviously, I struggle with it quite a bit. And so a lot of it just has to do with I just kind of listen to my body. I realized that the problem I've noticed is that a lot of people will land and then they'll just be like, I'm going to force myself to stay awake until, you know, a normal time to go to sleep, 8 or 9 p.m., you know, an early time. But, you know, you're exhausted. You've been awake for 40 hours or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And figure, all right, then I'll sleep through the night and I'll be on a normal schedule. Now, for me, I just will wake up. And I know a lot of other people are similar. We're like, well, you'll just wake up after, you know, around 2 a.m. and you won't be able to go back to sleep. And that's not especially helpful for me at all. So for me, I prefer to just, all right, I'll go sleep for a couple hours because I'm exhausted and I've been awake for 30 hours. And I'll force myself to wake up so that I'm still tired at night. And then I'll sleep for as long as my body will let me and just hope for the best kind of thing. And realize that there's a good chance I'll be awake at, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. And we'll try our best again the next day. And hopefully, if the tournament's not the day after that, we'll be adjusted at least a little bit by then.
We'll be on time. There you go. So you mentioned your article column that you write. It's daily, and that goes up on Channel Fireball. Is that right?
That's right.
Excellent. So as far as like resources that you can refer to people who want to keep their finger on the pulse of magic, Channel Fireball being one of them. Are there any other resources that you mentioned, or is that the best one?
I think Channel Fireball is the best one by like kind of a wide margin just because there's so much content there. There's so much every day. There's videos and articles, and the player quality that they have that are writing these articles is pretty phenomenal. I mean, there are other sites as well that have, you know, good content. Some of them charge for it. Some of them are free. You know, of course, TCG Player has some fantastic writers, you know, Seth Manfield and Steve Rubin and Brian Bronduin, who are all, of course, fantastic Magic players and people and writers. So there's definitely other sites to go as well. But for me, I go to Channel Fireball many times per day because there's articles that get posted kind of sporadically. And, you know, I also, I mean, I'm not really out here to show their products, but I do buy a lot of my singles and other stuff from them. So
cool.
It's definitely a site that I go to the most.
Cool. We'll link to it in the show notes for sure. As we close things out, I want to remind the Prodigies, if you want to connect with Eric, you can do so on Twitter. That's the best place, at EFROPoker. Very active there. You can reach out and find him there. So as we close things up, Eric, what is one last parting piece of guidance you have for us? Either something you already said that you want to emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end.
You want a piece of guidance? I mean, you just got to follow your heart. Like, if Magic, if you're not feeling it right now, it's okay to take a break. Like, the game will still be there. It's something I've done multiple times. And it's kind of fantastic in a lot of ways because you just kind of come back, well, at least for me, just feeling pretty passionate about it and wanting to get out there. And, you know, I'll not play a format for a long time, and then it becomes exciting again. Like, Modern is a format for me that, you know, I think it doesn't work as a professional format. Like, there's just so many things that kind of make it into a coin flip format, incredibly high variance, but it's still enjoyable. So when I don't get to play Modern for a few months, getting to go play a Modern Grand Prix is exciting. I traveled, you know, several hours away by flight to go play a Modern Grand Prix. And then if they put a Modern Pro Tour and a Modern Grand Prix back to back, and I'll not want to play again for a few more months, but it's just kind of, you know, finding that moderation for me, at least, that, you know, keeps things exciting and having different ways to play Magic. And with some people, it's Magic Online and being able to play formats like Cube and whatnot. That's not really for me, but for a lot of people, they love it. And so, I don't think that anyone should take anything too seriously. I'm forcing yourself to go play Magic because there's a PPTQ and, you know, you're burned out and you don't really feel like playing whatever the format is right now. I think it's more than okay to take a break. Like, the game will be there even if you have to miss something that, you know, you kind of do want to be playing in. If you're burned out, just kind of allow yourself to make those decisions, and you'll enjoy it a lot more for a lot longer.
Sweet. Well, Eric, I want to acknowledge you. Thank you so much for your time and for your contributions to the multiverse. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
Yeah, that's the goal. It hasn't been working out all that well. I got mana screwed a lot.
Well, how about that? Eric Froelich himself on the show. How cool is that? I love it when we get to have some big names on the show. It's really kind of cool to hear their perspective and see Magic from a new light, right? It's really neat to have big Hall of Famers as well as people who just made their first top 8, right? It's so cool that we can learn from both of them. And I think that having that dichotomy of perspective is crucial. So I love this chat with Eric. I hope you did as well. And I'd love to hear what you think. So feel free to reach out to me, send me an email, hit me up on Facebook, but I really want your feedback on how these interviews are going. If you like the new direction, if you like the new focus on sportsmanship, dedication, and respect, I really want to kind of move away from the rote pattern that we've had for the last while and really get to talking about things that make a difference in your life as a Magic player and as a person. I really want to dive into that more and improve as an interviewer to really give you some meaningful stuff. And your feedback is greatly appreciated. So let me know what you like, what you want to hear. We'll make this the best show it possibly could be. So thanks so much for tuning in today. I want to say thank you again to the patrons and to Paragon City Games. And to you, my fine prodigies, get out there and play some Magic this weekend. Turn some cardboard sideways and have a blast. Until next time, I can't wait to connect with you again next week. And until then, I'm Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.